is Bean to Barstool, a podcast that looks at the intersections of craft beer and craft chocolate. My name is David Nilsson. I'm a professional beer writer and an advanced Cicerone, and the creator and host of this show. The music for this episode is by my dear friend, indie folk musician Anna P.S. You can find out more about Anna's music in the show notes or at her website, annapsmusic.com. You can find links and information about our guests in the show notes as well. I hope you enjoy this episode of Bean to Barstool. A reliable way to start an argument in beer or chocolate is to ask what someone thinks the word craft means and which companies get to be described that way. Is it about size, independent ownership, flavor? In the beer world, I've been on different sides of these arguments in the past, but honestly, the ability to draw clean lines in what we broadly call craft beer disappeared years ago as the segment matured from a scrappy niche market to a multi-billion dollar industry. I write about beer full-time, and even I can't always keep track of who owns whom anymore, and I'm not sure what independence even means once a brewery reaches a certain production size. That's not to say paying attention to where my dollars go doesn't matter. At all scales of size and models of ownership, there are beer operations I respect and support, and others I don't. The craft chocolate industry is a couple decades behind the growth trajectory of craft beer, and the dynamics of chocolate sales aren't directly comparable to beers anyway. But the stakes of these definitions in chocolate feel different. I see arguments on social media about who gets to be craft in the chocolate world, and sometimes they're about size or ownership, and to be honest, I usually sigh deeply and wish there was a way to spare the segment these growing pains, knowing how fruitless they prove to be on the beer side. But when we start talking about the ethics of cacao sourcing, child slavery, underpaid farmers and farm laborers, ecological irresponsibility, etc., the definition of craft can start to carry more significance. Today we're talking with Brad Kintzer, the chocolate maker for Cho Chocolate in Berkeley, California, a company some of you might not consider craft. They're bigger than most craft makers, their prices are proportionately lower, and they're owned by a very large overseas corporation. They have advantages a small maker making and wrapping every bar by hand simply doesn't. The first and last of those concerns, size and ownership, definitely run against the plucky artisan image of craft chocolate, the stories it tells, perhaps most especially to itself, and I won't pretend corporate ownership doesn't worry me a little. But it's the middle one, price, that has given me the most pause over the years. How can Cho sell chocolate bars for $5 if they're paying enough for their cacao? And it's still something I want to understand better. Brad tells me Cho offers traceability and transparency reports for all their beans, though I don't feel qualified to interpret those well and understand what counts as a fair price in every instance. If you've taken a look at these, let me know. If you've had questions about Cho, maybe don't consider them craft. That's fair. I fell in love with craft chocolate through very small makers, and I'm cheering for all those makers today. I support them as much as possible, both with my dollars and through this platform, and they tend to have more compelling stories to tell than their larger cousins. But if craft chocolate is ever going to grow to the point it makes a significant impact on the cacao supply chain, and we see the real improvement we're looking for, that's going to have to include makers of all sizes. There's going to be stratification, and that's not a bad thing. The goal is farmers and laborers getting paid fairly, cacao being grown sustainably, and higher quality chocolate making it into the hands of consumers. For craft chocolate to grow, it will have to include larger makers, and it's my opinion we should welcome that with some qualifications, as bigger makers can buy more beans from more farmers and can reach and educate more consumers. We should pay attention, ask direct questions, require direct answers. When Brad and I first spoke about doing an interview, I told him I would need to ask him some honest questions about Cho's sourcing, pricing, and corporate ownership, and he agreed. I'll leave it up to you to decide if you're satisfied with the answers, though I do ask that you listen to the interview and consider it thoughtfully. I welcome respectful, reasoned dialogue on this topic on our Instagram page or via email through our website. In our conversation, aside from the questions I mentioned above, Brad and I talked about the flavor labs Cho has established in many cacao growing regions to work with growers on a mutually informed flavor lexicon for chocolate and to improve quality. We spent about the last third of the interview talking about Cho's relationship to craft beer, both through the cacao nibs they provide to hundreds of brewers through their relationship with BSG, Brewers Supply Group, a major ingredient provider, and through direct collaborations with breweries like Fieldwork and Faction. These collabs have resulted in some really unique chocolate beers and, most recently, a beer chocolate bar called Hoppy Hour. Brad says dozens of beers have been brewed with Cho's nibs, but I can tell you that number is actually more likely over 1,000. BSG's reach is massive, and there's a decent chance if a chocolate beer doesn't say whose nibs it's using, it's Cho. Here's Brad Kinser of Cho Chocolate. Brad, at the outset here, why don't you tell us a little bit about Cho's relationships with farmers at origin? How are you going about sourcing your cacao?
Yeah, sure. So the farmers are the most important people in our process, really. And that's because they're growing the most important ingredient in our product. So it's something that we have learned over the years to innovate as much as possible with farmers. One of the examples is we started out with this dream of creating different flavored chocolates, naturally flavored from different cocoa beans and that. And really it was a challenge because it was many cocoa farmers that we were working with had rarely tasted chocolate made from their own beans. And obviously that's sad because chocolate is amazing and something we all know and love here, but it was also a big challenge for us to be able to get the quality that we and, you know, it's just purely a cash crop for many communities. Obviously, lots of exceptions to that. But when we were starting out, we realized that process of farmers sending us cocoa samples, us assessing them, sending feedback was really slow. It took a long time for farmers to send us stuff. It took us a long time to get the cocoa processed and send feedback. And then by the time all that was done, it was almost, you know, we had to wait till the next harvest season. So one of the early innovations that Cho made really was setting up laboratories at cocoa farming cooperatives. These cooperatives have been our partners since 2009, 2010. Most of them are maintained many of the same cooperatives for the last 15 years or so. And it means everything to us. It means everything to our quality and the products that we make. So these labs enable farmers to make smart business decisions based on quality of their cocoa, how it relates to value. And so that's really the key. One of the key nodes that we have, like we have about 10 of these labs around the world, and many of the cooperatives are now interacting with each other, learning from each other. So it's really the cornerstone of everything we do, working directly with these farmers through the labs, being able to calibrate with them flavor, being able to answer so many of the questions that we all have related to flavor, related to productivity, related to fermentation, related to really you name it. There's so many questions that are still out there in the world of cocoa. Many of them are excitedly being answered now, or at least addressed. So that's what's, you know, maybe one of the most exciting things about seeing the craft chocolate world where it is right now is a lot of people are asking great questions, finding ways to get those answers. So
you're getting all of your cacao directly from farms or co-ops, or are you working with any kind of intermediaries?
So there's different levels of intermediaries, but yes, we're working directly with farmers, cooperatives for the cocoa that we purchase. We have probably about 8 or 10 cooperatives that we work with around the world. Ecuador, Peru, Ghana are the key cooperatives that we work with. But
cool. One question I know has come up from talking with other folks, and one that I've had in the past, is some of your bars are priced lower than we would expect to see from a lot of craft and bean to bar makers. And that typically leads me to be wary, because the low cost of chocolate usually means low cost of the cacao that they're buying. Talk a little bit about why we see those types of prices from some of your bars.
Well, I think it's our cocoa, our chocolate bars are right now priced at anywhere between $4.50 and $6, I would say, on average. So it's certainly not really low compared to many. But, you know, for us, one of our early inspirations as a company was to be able to bring better chocolate, better in flavor, better in sustainability to more people. And so it was always something that we wanted to be able to do. And we set up our company in that way to be able to do that. And so we didn't start micro small. We started on a larger, little bit of a larger size. We're still very, very small compared to any household names, of course, but it was really designed that way from the beginning to be able to make high quality at a slightly larger scale. And the cocoa, the Cho flavor labs, the little bean to bar labs that are populated throughout most of our cooperatives that we work with are really the key to that. We're able to get a higher quality cocoa. We're able to pay directly to those cooperatives a better price. And we're able to ship basically larger quantities. Just basic economies of scale are at play. And really, we, in terms of payment to farmers, we're paying on average, I think, probably 50% over market price for most of our cocoa, almost all of our cocoa. I think it's on average, it's 50%. So some is more, some is less, but yeah.
And do you offer any kind of like transparency reports or anything that verifies the prices you're paying for your cacao?
We do, yeah. So we have a transparency report. We've just sort of recently been sort of formalized it, but we've been very sort of open and transparent with almost everything we do. That was another thing that we wanted to do from the beginning of our company. Since pretty much day one, we had public tours for free, come to our factory, take pictures, take videos, see what we're doing. We've always been inspired by kind of pulling back the curtain in the world of chocolate a bit, shedding some light on what really happens. We're definitely not perfect, but we like the challenge of improvement. We like the idea of how can we make this more transparent? How can we make this better tasting? How can we make this more exciting for the consumer? So, yeah.
I know you've shared previously that you are also roasting at origin, which would be different from what a lot of bean-to-bar makers are doing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The model for Cho has always been one where we try to roast as much as possible at origin. We do that for a few reasons. One is that it's a great job creator at origin. One of the companies that we work with right now is Norandino, and they're a cooperative in South America, in Peru, where they're a farmer cooperative, but they also owned and created just recently a large-scale roaster that allows us to take their cocoa and roast it with them. It adds value to them, to their bottom line. It also adds value to us. We're able to deliver really a fantastic quality cocoa and chocolate and cocoa liquor. They're bringing it to cocoa liquor, which is then shipped to us here in Berkeley. The benefits to them financially are really fantastic. The benefits to us are fantastic financially and quality wise. And also there's other benefits, like we're able to ship cocoa liquor without, including the shell, some of that extra weight. So it ends up being quite a bit lower in carbon footprint for shipping, that sort of thing. We're also able to process organically much easier. So we've always had a focus on organic. And so bringing cocoa beans into the United States, it gets tricky with insects, bugs, a lot of fumigation at the port and that kind of thing. If you want to avoid that, it tends to be quite expensive. Refrigerated containers, flushed containers, that sort of thing. So yeah, we've always enjoyed the challenge of roasting at origin. We do that in Peru. We do that in Ecuador. We do that in Ghana. It's a very different model than traditional bean to bar, but it's something that we really love.
I'm curious on how that cost savings works for you. I understand the lower shipping cost. You're also now paying additional, for the labor that's happening at origin there. How does that end up falling out for you from a purely financial standpoint? Is it just that reduced shipping cost and you don't have to have the equipment?
It's some reduced shipping costs. It's also just labor is much less expensive in many of these countries. The cost of having a roaster in Ghana is much less expensive than having one in the Bay Area, for example. And really the question for us was always, the key driver was always one of, can we make as good, if not better, quality with these systems? And after a lot of trials and testing, we found that it is possible. So that's what really unlocked it.
We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. Getting a Cicerone certification is an amazing way to raise your beer knowledge and can be a game changer for your beer career. But how are you supposed to find the time to prep, and how are you supposed to know exactly what to study? Don't sweat, because the Beer Scholar has you covered. The Beer Scholar is a sponsor of Bean to Barstool, but I can tell you from personal experience years before I was doing this podcast how helpful the Beer Scholar study guides are. They offer efficient online courses for levels 1 and 2 that cover everything you need to know, tips and tricks for how to pass the exams, and include live weekly Zooms to taste and discuss classic beer styles together. They even have a new coaching program for the level 3 advanced Cicerone exam. I used the Beer Scholar study guide to pass my level 2 exam many years ago. I wish the level 3 had been around when I took that exam. I had to do it on my own. Wish their study guides had been available for that at the time. The vast majority of certified Cicerones in the world today have used Beer Scholar to help achieve the goal of passing that exam. If you are ready to take your beer career to the next level, visit thebeerscholar.com and check out their online courses. With the flavor labs you were talking about at these different origins around the world, beyond just the benefit of higher quality cacao, ideally coming out of this, what is this doing for the origin? What are some of the other benefits you're seeing for these farms and co-ops to have these on site?
Well, many of these cooperatives, so I think there's 8 different cooperatives that have CHO flavor labs, and then there's 2 sort of government cocoa laboratories that have the CHO flavor labs, one in Ecuador and one in Ghana. And every story is very different. So it's hard to just, you know, broad stroke it, but it's in short, we have a lot of cooperatives are growing lots of cocoa. Some of our cooperatives might only grow 200 tons of cocoa a year, some growing close to 5,000 tons a year. So if we're CHO over here, we might be buying 25 tons of cocoa from a cooperative every year, might be buying 100 tons, but either way, it's usually pretty small quantity in relation to what the cooperative is growing overall. And so one of the benefits for these cooperatives is that they're able to fully understand their products, right? It's you know, the cocoa bean is what they're making and they're selling. And so for them to understand it on a deeper quality level is key to survival as an organization. And so that's really where we see the best success stories, is when the cooperatives are able to understand and make smart business decisions based on what their understanding of the market needs are. So we have, for example, you might have a cooperative where they've always just been collecting all of the cocoa and mixing it together, right? You have the cocoa on one side of the river and it's yellow pods. Other side of the river, it's red pods. They've always mixed it together, but they can start to ask questions like, what if we separated them, right? What if we took the red pods and fermented them separately from the yellow pods? And what would happen in terms of value to those different cocos? Would they lessen in value? Would they increase in value? Would they lessen for some customers but increase for others? That's usually the case. So you might have somebody like CHO that's going to pay twice as much for the yellow pods. They just think it's the most beautiful, exquisite, fruity flavor, for example, whereas someone else might not want that fruity flavor, but they're looking for more of the profile that's coming from the red pods. And of course, this is a very simplified example that's, you know, not including fermentation and many other things. But we've seen examples like this many, many times over, where the cooperatives are able to make smart business decisions. They might say, hey, let's cut down all the yellow pods because they're not productive and no one really likes the flavor. And or maybe some people like it, but they're not buying that much. So let's change our mix of genetics for the organization or something like that. So it's an amazing tool for the cooperatives to be able to make better business decisions. So when we first started installing these labs, you know, I think it was 2009 or so, we were getting cocoa samples from many of these cooperatives. And we rejected probably 80 to 85% of the cooperative samples. You know, I get a 2-kilo bag. It represented 5 tons, 10 tons, 20 tons, whatever it was. We probably, on average, I would say we rejected probably 80%. And there were things like moldiness. There was things like excessive bitterness. There were all kinds of, unusual flavors. Sometimes it was just, really flat. Sometimes it was too fruity, whatever it might be. But once we installed these labs, had some time training, really training each other in terms of sensory understanding, sensory language, understanding, just calibrating. Within a year or two, we saw just an absolute huge change in the quality, and for almost across the board. And I would say after that, we were rejecting probably 20%. And so just having that basic, very basic, rudimentary, lab. And when I use the word lab, it's a very simple lab, not unlike someone making bean to bar chocolate in their garage or something like that. Just a basic roaster, winnowing, grinding, some tempering, some molds, that kind of thing. So, but we've just seen so many great improvements. And again, getting to some of those questions that are so diverse, but are common throughout the whole world, right? What effect does this fermentation have on the cocoa? What does this genetics, look like compared to that genetics with the same fermentation, with different fermentation? That stuff takes time. To be sending samples to us in Berkeley or others, it's great, but also it's really most powerful can be done at origin.
One thing I'm interested in that you're doing at these origins is working to develop a mutually informed flavor vocabulary. One of the things that happens so often with chocolate, it seems like, is it's predominantly enjoyed in the global north. It's predominantly grown in the global south. We have completely different flavor vocabularies based on culture and climate and all sorts of different things. And our vocabulary gets enforced. What are some of the things you're doing at Origin to come up with a mutual lexicon that everybody can draw on?
Yeah, that's a great one and a really challenging one, but maybe the most exciting one. If I'm sitting here in California and I'm thinking about fruitiness, I might be thinking about raspberries, blueberries, something of that nature for a specific profile. We go down to the Amazon and are working with some cooperatives in the Amazon or in West Africa or something like that. It's likely the case that many have never even tasted a blueberry or a raspberry, right? So there's, and likewise, I've never tasted what they're using as a flavor reference for fruitiness, right? So it's really kind of block and tackle sort of stuff where we go down there, we bring freeze-dried fruit powders for our flavor references. We go to the markets down there. We find all kinds of juices and vinegars, and even just soil samples that can recreate some of the off notes, for example, bitterness, different root drinks and things like that that are common in many parts of global south. So it's a fun challenge. It mostly just takes sitting in a room together for a couple weeks pretty regularly to just talk about it. When you have those conversations, it becomes very personal, right? I remember my grandmother had this fruit growing in her yard, or I remember this or that. And so you just find that you just build these connections with the farmers, with the technical directors of the sensory panels at the cooperatives. So it's really some of the most fun that we ever have is just talking about flavors. And you can transcend this, the language differences. It's possible. It's not always easy. You have to learn new words. You have to taste new things. It's the hardest challenge for a chocolate maker is just communicating. How do I communicate with all these people that are so far away, geographically, but also so far away socioeconomically, so far away culturally, from a linguistics perspective? So it's, I think it's what's so captivating about the world of craft chocolate is that, like you said, most of it is made and consumed in the north, but it's really the heart of it is in the south. And so it's something that kind of forces you to engage with other worlds, other cultures. And if you're going to do it well, if you're going to make great chocolate, you have to do that, and you have to communicate in a better way. And that's really what these flavor labs have allowed us to at least open the door for what we always think of as like a co-creation of this cacao. It's something that it's not us going down there and, you know, telling, you know, farmers what to do. It's about how do we unlock the secrets of this cocoa that you have growing here. And is there a way that we can make it the best possible cocoa? And also we're able to pay, you know, a much higher price directly to be able to get that cocoa. So
yeah, flavor is such a dynamic way for people of different backgrounds to be able to get to know each other.
Yeah.
Can you share maybe one example of a tasting experience like this or a flavor that, you know, it took a little time for you and the others to be able to come to a common understanding of?
Sure. The first stumbling block that is usually that we usually come across is just talking about bitterness and astringency. Those things are, even with, you know, chefs and people that, you know, are really in the deep in the food world, the sophisticated food world, it's surprising how often those are, you know, looked at incorrectly. And so often it's just a lot of conversations about bitterness, astringency, understanding those things, you know, off notes. I love your, what you do with beer and the intersection of chocolate. I took a Cicerone class for off flavors of beer. And it was like looking into the future, you know, it was like talking about, you know, molecules. It was talking about the chemistry behind it. It was talking about, you know, how do we prevent off flavors? It was so well mapped out, and it was clear that this wasn't recently done. Mm-hmm. You know, this was done decades ago, and I don't feel like that work has yet been done in cocoa. And so it's immediately frustrating. I want to take the off flavors of cacao course that's really knows what it's talking about, and you know, I can learn everything, but also I don't think it's ever really, you know, it just hasn't been figured out yet. I think people are starting to figure it out, but certainly when we were starting out in 2009, there wasn't a lot of sophisticated understanding of this stuff. And so, you know, just even the elimination of off notes is more than half the battle with cacao. It has to be done. There's no question about it. You can't have moldy cocoa. You can't have musty cocoa. You can't have smoky cocoa. I mean, unless that you're getting weird and you want to have a smoky, you know, PNG, Papua New Guinea or something, chocolate bar or something. But so much of it is just the basics, just getting the basics down that, again, have been worked out so well in beer and wine, and cheese and bread and for decades. And, you know, it's definitely the most frustrating part of being in craft chocolate, but also, you know, it allows a company like Cho and others to ask some really basic questions about foundational questions and be able to answer those or try to answer those and move the needle in terms of flavor. So
you had a sentence a little bit ago where you talked about not going in and telling a farmer what to do. Sure. One of the risks with just kind of inherent to bean to bar chocolate is perpetuating some of the damages of colonialism in many of these countries, even with the best intentions. There can be a white savior complex. There can be all sorts of different ways that can play out. Beyond some of the ones we've talked about, can you share some other examples of ways that you work to avoid that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always try to be sensitive to that. The friendships that we have at Origin with these cocoa farmers, scientists, we really feel like we're in partnership with all these people, you know, these cooperatives, these farmers, these scientists. We could not do what we do without them. And they really inspire us. And so, I don't know, you know, finding ways to work together to create something new that's new and different and overall helpful in the trajectory of chocolate and the history of chocolate is what inspires us. So there's a lot of different examples. We're working with small cooperatives on, you know, fine tuning some flavorful beans. We're working with, for example, we're working with the Cocoa Research Institute of Ghana. We're building a laboratory there, and really, it's going to be one of a kind flavor center. It's going to be primarily focused on untangling the mysteries of cocoa flavor, genetics, fermentation, drying, chocolate making. It's really something we're really excited by. And one of the things that I think about is a big threat to to the cacao world, especially in a place like West Africa, is climate change. And so finding, we need to be more sophisticated. We need to be more advanced in how we look at cacao and what's inevitably coming with regards to climate change. So thinking about new varietals, thinking about ways to innovate in the breeding world that allows for there to be cocoa that can be grown in drier areas, cocoa that can be grown in wetter areas, that also doesn't absolutely taste like you're chewing on, you know, burnt tires. So there's a lot at risk. I know West Africa gets criticized maybe by the craft world for being sort of bulk and pedestrian flavor profile, but there's something beautiful about that deep, rich, fudgy, brownie chocolate profile that is that's really primarily comes from Ivory Coast, Ghana. And so finding ways to look ahead, look to the future, to be able to preserve those heritage flavors, the country heritage flavors of for example, Ghana, we're primarily focused on, is something that's really inspiring for what we're doing right now. And we're working with Ghanaian cocoa scientists over there to put things together to try to map out genetically what they have available, what diseases are threatening those cocos, how can we start now to breed new types of cocoa that will be able to be flavorful, rich, delicious, chocolatey, so to speak, and other flavors, but you know, preserving that heritage flavor. We've seen a loss of that flavor with a lot of the new hybrids and other things. So that's something that is really inspiring to us.
Well, a few years after CHO started, the company was purchased by an overseas corporation. And if we're honest, that's something that hasn't always sat well with a lot of folks in the craft world. Craft kind of has this self-image of being small and scrappy. And coming from the craft beer world, I've seen a similar dynamic there as it was growing. And these small breweries were not necessarily small anymore. And they were getting purchased by larger macro brewers and that sort of thing. Can you share a little bit about the nature of the corporate ownership of CHO and how that plays out in your business operations?
Sure. In 2018, I believe it was, 2018, a company called Azaki Glico purchased us. They're most known in the United States for a product called Pocky Sticks. Those are like sort of chocolate dipped pretzel sticks kind of thing. And it's really a household name in Japan. It's a 100-year-old company. It's family owned, publicly traded though, and it is to be perfectly honest, it was a little bit nerve-wracking to begin with. You know, I wasn't sure what to expect, but the company has a passion for innovation. They have a passion for changing the world of chocolate. The great grandson of the founder is the CEO and president. And he is a total foodie. He's passionate about food. He's passionate about chocolate. And he loves what CHO has been doing. He wants to see us do even more. And that's you know, this laboratory that I was just referring to in Ghana at the Cocoa Research Institute at Krieg, that's being funded in large part by Azaki Glico, a parent company. So they're fully focused on, you know, really pushing chocolate to a better place. I can't ask for more as an employee. Learned a lot from them. You know, when you have a large confectionery company like themselves that's 100 years old, they have a lot of resources, historic research that has been done over the decades. You know, so for myself, who's in R&D and here in chocolate for the last 20 plus years, it's something that, you know, is very inspiring. I learn a lot, and I think they learn a lot from us and what we're doing. So there's it's a great, really mutually beneficial relationship that's really, let's say, thriving at this point. So
obviously you can't please everyone, but you know, there are a lot of very small makers out there who Sure. are trying to do everything themselves without those resources and might look at something like CHO and say, well, that's not fair. You know, that's not what I'm dealing with. How would you address or respond to that within a single definition of, you know, the craft chocolate world?
Well, I guess as someone who's been at a few different craft chocolate companies, I definitely, I hear where they're coming from. And you know, I'm rooting for them in many ways. And, you know, Cho was a small company, and we still are a small company. You know? So it's something that, you know, I think we're more aligned than they might think in terms of where we want to go. And I think when I think about how do we change the world of chocolate, it's how do we get consumers to be inspired by what we're doing, by what those smaller makers are doing. And, you know, that's the key. I mean, that's the prize, right? Is we need consumers to be focused on how do we change it up from big chocolate. You know, there's a lot of good people in big chocolate. There's a lot of good, you know, initiatives and that sort of thing. But how do we bring them to a new world of chocolate? Like, kind of, you know, there was an old Special K, the cereal. There was an old jingle that they had. It was like, Special K, try it again for the first time, right? And it was it sticks in my head. It's kind of like chocolate. You know, I want people to try it again for the first time. Like, people are used to big chocolate, Hershey, Mars, Snickers. You know, it's delicious. I love peanut M&Ms as much as anybody else. But as most of your listeners know, there's a whole world of opportunity, of flavor, of improved sustainability in smaller makers, and including Cho and the work that we're doing. Is, you know, we're proud of it, and, you know, proud of the work that a lot of these smaller makers are doing too. So I feel like it's hopefully we can grow the whole thing. So.
Well, we both mentioned beer several times, and Cho has a significant relationship with the world of craft beer, even if a lot of people might not realize that. A lot of the chocolate beers that are out there are using Cho nibs, even if that's not necessarily showing up on a can label. Talk a little bit about what Cho does in the world of craft beer.
Yeah, so beer and chocolate have always been perfect partners. From a sensory profile, tasting chocolate with beer is one of my favorite things. Putting nibs into beer can be and cocoa powder and even chocolate pieces into beer can be a beautiful, beautiful experiment. And with the explosion of craft beer all over the world, really, we've seen a lot of innovation coming from brewers who are interested in trying something new, whether it's coffee or cacao or vanilla or whatever it might be. And so we work with a distributor who supplies a lot of small and medium-sized breweries with our nibs. We have several different nibs that we offer for breweries. And it's been a fun and frankly unexpected part of our business. But it's always highlight of my day to taste a beer that's made with our nibs, for sure. So,
and that's BSG, right, that you're working with?
Yes, BSG. Exactly.
Through BSG, I mean, they are one of the primary ingredient suppliers for craft beer in the United States. Do you have numbers or estimates on how many breweries that you are then reaching with those nibs?
You know, I wish I did. It's something I'm always asking our sales team, what beers are, you know, using our nibs? And I don't know as much as I'd like to about that. But there's probably been dozens of different beers that have used our nibs over the years, and some of them are sort of one-offs and they're perfect and delicious, and then others are pretty consistent. They have like a seasonal beer. A lot of these tend to be more of a seasonal, a fall winter weather kind of profile beer, stout, porters, that sort of thing. But one of the more exciting developments recently is like kind of exploring even putting nibs into a lager. You do a double take, if not a triple take, tasting it, because it just tastes so chocolatey, but it's got this nice light color, straw color profile. It's pretty wild. So when those are done well, those are really fun.
Yeah, I'll ask you more about that in just a sec, because I'm very interested in it. You mentioned you have a couple different nibs available for breweries. I've been primarily aware of Ghana as an origin that most breweries are using from Cho because it has that classic chocolatey flavor. What are some of the nibs that you are making available?
So we have Ghana, which is that deep, rich, fudgy brownie profile that you just described. We also have Ecuador, which is also on that roastier side, but a little bit more nutty, a little bit more maybe herbal in certain ways. And then we also have Peru, which is completely different and a lot more in that fruity spectrum, which is, it's not for everyone. When you make a beer with cacao, you want it to taste like cacao. And a lot of times with a fruitier nib, it's not going to punch through as much, but we've seen some really creative usage of that one as well. So, but yeah, it's mostly Ghana, some Ecuador, and they're all organic, they're all fair trade, and they're all fully traceable.
We'll be right back.
Hey everyone, Final Gravity issue 4 is now available in the Bean to Barstool shop. This fourth issue of our zine telling intimate, human-centered stories from the world of beer is full of great articles, including Kate Power of Lady Justice Brewing talking about why she might be done with beer festivals, Ukrainian beer writer Lana Svitnikova writing about the Zeugel brewing tradition in Germany, UK writer Matthew Curtis talking about the blend of old and new in the cask ale tradition in Manchester, and many more. We believe passionately in this project, and if you believe the story of beer is ultimately a story about people and relationships, we think you'll love Final Gravity as well. You can order the new issue from our shop on beantobarstool.com, or you can also subscribe, including subscribing for your brewery tap room or break room, or you can subscribe and sign up to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/beantobarstoolzines. Now, back to the episode. And with you roasting at origin, how does that work? You just earmark those to come over as nibs instead of converting that to chocolate liquor?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And with working through BSG, are you just sending large bulk of this to them for their warehouse, or are they passing along orders to you for fulfillment?
It's a little bit of both. So we get regular orders from them, and then we'll send those out. So
sure. Well, you had one really interesting collaboration recently with Fieldwork Brewing. Fieldwork is a highly esteemed brewery, of course, well known for their IPAs largely. And you made an IPA with cacao, which is something I have been very interested in because I think there's a lot of potential for what cacao and hops can do together, but they haven't really been used that much. So talk a little bit about that collaboration.
Yeah. So Fieldwork's just up the street. Great folks, and you know, phenomenal beer. I think they have, let's say they have like almost 9 locations around the Bay Area, the Northern California area. So a lot of, you know, brew pubs and that kind of thing. And yeah, they just make great stuff. There's so many great breweries in the Bay. It's out of control. I've just hardly been to any of them, and I feel like I'm at one regularly. But so we did a collaboration with them where we made a chocolate bar, and they made a beer. They actually made 2 different beers, and it was so fun. They took a light IPA, and they put Ghana nibs into the IPA. I'm sorry, Peruvian nibs in the IPA. So it was like this like fruit on fruit almost profile, which really, it was really a mind teaser, because you're getting this fruitiness, you're getting this woodiness, you're getting this citrusiness, you're getting this pininess. And it was like, wait, is that from the hops or is that from the nibs? It was fascinating. It was almost like they dry hopped, but they used nibs. And so those nibs added this very, there's a very light chocolate note, which at first I was kind of like, oh, where's the chocolate? But then I realized because there are these Peruvian nibs, it really had this big presence, but it was just masquerading as a hop. So yeah, pretty out there concept, definitely not so mainstream, but you know, but one for the true, it's one for you, David, for sure.
Yeah, no, I would love to see how that worked out. You mentioned it was a subtle chocolate flavor and just lends those other fruity notes. If somebody didn't know that you had put nibs in this beer and tasted it, do you think that they would recognize there was something else there? Is it just a very complex fruity flavor?
I think some people would know, some people wouldn't. It's a good question. I'm not sure. It definitely is. It's definitely mild cocoa notes. It comes in the finish. Some people got it more strongly than others, like everything, right? But yeah, it was a fascinating one.
And then you mentioned they made a second beer as well?
Yeah, they did another one. I'm trying to remember exactly what style it was, but it was a darker beer. And yeah, that was another great one. I believe that one had Ghana nibs in it. Yeah, very, very interesting. Very creative brewers over there. There's just no shortage of innovation in the beer world. And I think that's one of the things that inspires me is just going, I'll just walk to the supermarket or wherever and look at the beer shelf. And it's just the packaging design, the naming, the flavors are just so far out there, inside jokes, just very, very funny, creative. Just definitely inspiring to do something a little different. It'd be fun to, like, I love when I see that pop through, that sort of creativity, that irreverence pop through in the craft world. I'd rather go that way than go to preciousness of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of creative, irreverent wines that are out there, but I love seeing the craft world kind of, you know, have a good go at it, so to speak.
And then the other side of that collaboration was the bar that you mentioned, which I have had a chance to taste and really enjoyed. So this, I'm going to ask you about the process on this, but you used Pop Rocks to simulate carbonation a little bit. And I did not tell my wife and 16-year-old daughter that those were in there when I let them taste it. So they put the piece in their mouth and both were like, what the hell is that? So it was definitely a surprise for them. But tell us a little bit about that bar.
Yeah, so this is something that, I don't know. It's probably, I remember working on this bar years and years and years ago, just, you know, always just hitting my head against the wall. Cause it was like, okay, what do I do? Do I grind malts into it? Do I grind fresh hops into it? Do I dry, you know, pelletized hops, hop oils? You know, it never, never, ever came out right. And it was always excessively bitter, or I couldn't taste any of the hops, couldn't taste any of the beer. So this was like a bit of a long journey for this one that, you know, I'm just glad we finally came out with it. Sometimes these ideas get into your head and you just kind of need to somehow get it out. And so this was one of those things. We did a dark chocolate. We put Pop Rocks in there to kind of capture the effervescence of the beer experience. And then we found this small supplier of hops oil, and they actually do like a steam distillation of hops, and it's just the purest, most delicious, purest translation of the hops. And they do several, maybe 20 different varietals of hops. They grow them, they harvest them, and then they make a steam distillation of the hops oils. And their main market is actually just adding these for brewers to add into a regular old lager and turn it into something hoppy. They're mm-hmm. just kind of juice, like literally juicing it up. But we found that it can be a beautiful thing in chocolate, as it's also oil based. And that's the secret ingredient for that one for sure. And we used a Cascade, Centennial, and Chinook, I believe, were the three varieties.
Nice.
You could teach me more about, David, but those were sort of like the classic West Coast California IPA vibe hops. And we were looking at some of the newer New Zealand fruit forward hops and things like that, but again, it didn't come through in the chocolate as hops. It came through as fruitiness, which was really cool, but also, you know, if it's a beer bar, it kind of has to have that beer flag stuck in the ground. So
yeah, so are you just dropping that straight in when you're, you know, melanging, or like how are you actually adding that in?
It's fragile. So the oils are, we add them at the very, very end of the chocolate making process, so as not to, you know, if you were to conch it, you just lose it all.
Sure.
And Pop Rocks, by the way, I didn't realize this, but the Pop Rocks are also very temperature sensitive. So we made a batch of this and all the Pop Rocks died. They just, I mean, they were crunchy, but they weren't popping. And so I took the hit in the R&D team and we said, please, we gotta make this right. We can't have it without the Pop Rocks. We actually reran it at a lower temperature, and the temperature is like right, it's like right above. So basically you have to add them in while the chocolate's up.
Yeah. I was curious with like the fact that you're adding this in when it's still, you know, in a liquid state, how it's not just setting off the Pop Rocks.
Yeah. Well, if you go above about 95 degrees, it sets them off. But if you stay below 95, it's so.
Got
maybe
it.
Some people like your daughter and wife would prefer them not in there.
No, they ended up liking it. I think they thought it was more interesting than anything else, but I didn't warn them at all. So they could not understand why the chocolate was attacking them when they were tasting it. You mentioned a little bit ago that you're familiar with somebody putting cacao into a lager. Can you share a little more about that?
Yeah, so there's been a few people who have done that. The first time I ever tried that, I believe, was a guy who you might know by name, Roger, who was at Triple Rock Brewery. He owns his own brewing company called Faction Brewing. Faction's a famous brewery in the Bay Area. He had one that he made called the Anomaly, and I think it was a lager. It might have been a pilsner or something like that, but it was with cocoa nibs, and this was 10 years or more ago. It just kind of knocked my socks off. It was just, fun to try. I mean, there's so many great examples. There's a company down in LA, Anaheim area, actually, I think, called Everywhere Brewing. And there are some guys that used to be at the brewery. They made a grasshopper, so like the chocolate mint Cheesecake Factory kind of pie. And it was on a warm day. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever tasted. Yeah, surprising. Just big, beautiful cocoa flavor, some mintiness. They even had a little bit of green color to it, I think. And it was, just a work of art for sure. So,
What story is Cho Chocolate telling?
what story is Cho Chocolate telling? Wow. I think that's our biggest challenge. We're trying to tell so many stories. It's definitely our biggest challenge as a company. Is trying to figure out what story are we telling the story of the work that we're doing at the farms, flavor labs, and telling the story of like wild and zany chocolate flavors? Are we? I think we're trying to tell it all, and I think it works in some ways and it doesn't work in other ways. It's hard to put it all into, a 15-second sound bite, but we're just passionate about cacao. We're passionate about changing the world of chocolate. It's what the company was founded on. Yeah, we're just excited to be here and be a part of it.
Hoppy Hour is a really fun bar. It offers some crystal malt sweetness with a bit of Rice Krispies, accented by candied orange peel and what I imagine candied hops might taste like. The pop rocks are fun, spangling the tongue and roof of my mouth in little starbursts. Not sure it approximates carbonation, but that's hardly the point. It's fun and memorable and a very approachable way to do beer-infused chocolate. You can find out more about Cho and order their bars at the link in the show notes. Let me know what you think of our conversation and your thoughts on the definition of craft. Thanks to Brad for coming on the show today and to all of you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Bean to Barstool.